Community. Ladies and gentlemen,
appreciate you.
Burt Weiss with the Burt Show on the CEO Lawyer Podcast. There are people that I've already fired in my head, and I know they're not going to last because of the personality that they have.
So why not let them go now?
Redundancy and resiliency in your business.
Explain. So what I know about Islam is it is such a beautiful and peaceful religion. I think the branding of the religion
because
of extremists has really got people twisted about it.
Why do you think TikTok, why do you think there's such a strong push for TikTok to get banned?
Well, from my personal standpoint, I don't really buy into what the government is telling us about TikTok. I mean, I watched those hearings and I thought it was absolutely...
So today I want to talk about our evolution as entrepreneurs and how our desires and sort of what fuels us changes over the years as we become more mature entrepreneurs. But the grind is still in your heart. It's almost like it's ingrained in every moral fiber of your being. And today we are with none other than Burt Weiss with The Burt Show. And we got Jared Rosenberg on the ones and twos. So, yeah, man, that's what I want to talk about.
It might be a short conversation. Because I've never seen myself as really an entrepreneur or a businessman.
Hold on a second. We did last episode where... You started selling, what was it, like pictures
art?
Way back in the day. Yeah,
that was just, man, because I had to try to afford the weak-ass car that my parents gave me. But I've never been like a guy that has consciously, maybe now with Pioneer, with the podcasting network, I'm this way. But this might be the first project that I'm doing where I consciously am building a company from the ground floor up.
Yeah.
Whereas with the Burt Show... That was never my intention. My intention with the Burt Show was just survival. When we came to Atlanta, this was the only radio station that would give me a shot at a show. And, you know, over the course of the last 23 years now, I just signed a contract yesterday, actually.
Hey, congrats.
Thanks, man. I think it's become more business for me, but in the day-to-day, I still feel way more of a creative than I do the business side. I got business people around me making the numbers make sense for me, but I don't see myself as an entrepreneur.
I would have never guessed that.
No interest in it. I mean, it's nice. Don't get me wrong. I like money. I like vacations. I like living, earning what I have and living comfortably, but that was never my intent. It was just to be creative. And this has kind of been built. But as far as numbers go, man, I'll be honest with you. I don't even know what I make every 2 weeks. I have no idea what my annual salary is.
Wow, yeah. I am crazy super intentional about everything that I'm building.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, put it this way. I have bought domains and phone numbers that I've owned for longer than I've been a licensed attorney because I had a feeling that eventually – I'll need this domain, I'll need this phone number, I'll need this digital asset. And over the years, I've just experimented with so many different things, and I finally came back to the conclusion that if you want to be successful, you have to focus on one thing and become the absolute best at it. And then you can start doing some complementary businesses, things that support the first business that you built. But yeah, I was super intentional from day one. Like, I knew I had to get to eight figures very, very quickly, and I knew I had to do it faster than everyone else.
This is really going to be a fun conversation because I come from such a different place. I'm not sure how I had this awareness when I was younger, but I grew up with the polar opposite family life that you did. You told me last time we were hanging out that your family life's always been really, really great.
Yeah, I mean, I love my family. Like, when we hang out, it's just like best friends hanging out. I grew up with, you know, three brothers. We're all very close in age. Like, every one of us is like a year apart. Super competitive. Maybe other people think it's unhealthy, but for us, I feel like it's inspired us and motivated us to become better.
Yep.
And so any single one of us has a super unique story, but like when you put us together, it's like, this is wild. We should have a TV show.
So bringing it full circle here, when I was growing up, I had a very difficult household, man. I had parents that were very dismissive. We were more just kind of a pain than anything else. It was tough. My dad was really tough, and there wasn't a lot of intimacy or connection. And I'm not even sure how I had this awareness at 6 or 7 years old, but I knew that you had to have a certain amount of money if you wanted to go to the airport and buy a ticket that day and leave somewhere, that it was going to be way more expensive than if you did it in advance.
Yeah.
And I remember, even at like 7 years old, just wanting to escape my family. So my...
And you're not talking about like every 7, 8-year-old kid that takes their little suitcase and walks to the end of the road and then changes their mind and walks back. You're talking about intentionally planning to leave.
Yes.
And you, so you needed enough money to buy a plane ticket and get out of there.
Yes. So that was, had always been my goal. I just want enough money. And I didn't even know what that was. If you would have told me back then it was $75, then I would have gone, okay,
yeah,
that's $75. But I knew I wanted enough money to be able to go to the airport and leave and escape where I was. And that is really the only time that money had ever driven me. But I think I kept that mentality my entire life. And
you've just changed the goalpost.
Yeah, I really like my family now. I'd like to hang with them, and if I'm going to take a flight, they're invited.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, you've changed the goalpost of what the goal is. So instead of pain pushing you to get that $75 or whatever, it's more inspiration that, hey, I'd like to be able to take my family to this vacation whenever I feel like it, and that's going to cost me X dollars, so I need to have that disposable income.
Yes. And look, my vacations are my gold bars. So I work to provide for my family, and I work for vacations.
Okay.
Watches don't mean anything to me. Cars don't mean anything. Clearly, clothes don't mean anything to me. But that's really it. And that is sort of my driving force. I want to be creative and I want freedom. And I think working as hard as I have has given me the freedom that I want to do those vacations and be able to provide in a really, really solid way for my family.
So I do want to get deeper into your mind on this, because it's such a foreign concept to me that someone who owns a business doesn't think about money intentionally.
Right.
I seriously, like, I almost don't believe you.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's how detached I am from, I guess, reality.
But, or I'm detached from reality. One of us is.
No, I think you're normal. I'm the weird one. I mean, you use your passion for what you do to drive you to the financial goal. I used my financial goal to drive me to my passion.
Totally.
But we both ended in the same place, right? Which is we do what we love and we enjoy it and we make a lot of money at it. But to your point about cars and watches and stuff, there are only two things I spend money on.
And those are the two?
Cars and watches. Right.
Yeah.
But let me tell you why.
Okay.
Okay. Because here's the reason first why I like cars. Well, we grew up in a mechanic shop. Mm-hmm. My first workplace injury was when I was 8 years old. Right. I had a used tire explode in my face. And I remember we had this mechanic that was working on a customer's car, came in. This was at Murray Avenue in Dalton, Georgia. We rented out a little tire shop and a mechanic shop to be able to just have a business for my family. And the reason we started that business was because my dad had a Town and Country minivan that had the transmission go out not once, but twice. And every time they charged him $1,500. And when you're talking about $1,500 for immigrant parents that don't have US citizenship, that have five kids sitting in a 2,000 square foot pad trying to figure out how to get things going, that's very painful.
Yeah, man.
To the point where he's like, I never want to be in this position again, and I want to own my own mechanic shop. So guess what? We grew up in a mechanic shop. Mm. That's what it was. And I distinctly remember when I was like 8 years old, we had a mechanic that was working on this Ford Mustang convertible. And this was in December time. And once it was typical. Once you finish a car, it's normal to go and take it for a test drive. And I was like, 8 years old, is like, you going on a test drive? He's like, yep. I'm like, all right, can I come in? He's like, well, there's already someone in the passenger seat. I'm like, it's okay, I'll sit in the back. This was like 30 degrees outside. I'm like, can we put the convertible top down? And this first memory of driving in a convertible when I was 8 years old has pushed me to making sure I always have a convertible. And they've just kind of upgraded over the years. Even on the way here, I drove with my convertible top down. My hair looks crazy right now underneath all of this.
So that one I share with you. Yeah. Soft tops for the last 20 years for me. Yes.
Convertibles for sure. Like, I can't have a fast car, an exotic car that's not a convertible. I can't. I don't appreciate it. I don't care about the speed as much as I enjoy the wind in my hair, in my face, right? Now, with watches, there was a guy that... So my dad got his master's degree from Georgia Tech in 3 years, like 1980. And he used that degree to work at a bunch of different carpet mills. And he became like a very sought after engineer because he's just very, very smart. Like, my dad is extremely sharp. If you ever think like, wow, you just said something smart, it's like, for sure got it from my dad. So he got a master's degree, and in engineering, the PhD is the terminal degree. So there was a guy in the PE, the professional engineer sort of like status, is what is the highest degree that you can get in engineering. So my dad was one of the most knowledgeable people as engineer, but he didn't have the license that went along with it to make these sort of decisions like, I'm going to go ahead and build this project, or I'm going to construct this dam or this retaining wall or whatever it is. So he'd always have this PE, this professional engineer, that would have to sign off on all the work that my dad did. And my dad was a superior engineer, but that guy had the licensure. And this was sort of the interesting juxtaposition between super skilled, doesn't have the qualifications on paper, not very skilled, has the qualifications on paper. Guess who wins in America, mm-hmm. right? And so that guy had a Rolex.
Mm.
And
that thing was just shiny and bling, and it was singing to you.
I felt like he didn't deserve it.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, if this guy has it, and I don't have one, and my dad doesn't have one, then you best believe I'm going to get one, and I'm going to get my dad one. And I'm happy to say that I've done both.
Beautiful.
But even for both, mm-hmm. both of these things, for cars and watches, I don't buy retail. Everything that I buy, I have an exit strategy for it so that at least I break even or make money on the exit. Hmm. And so that way, my hobbies become investments. So I spent a lot of time really studying the watch market. I'm very in tune with like Rolex, AP, Patek pricing. And that's kind of how I'm known among some of my peers, attorneys, like, hey, you need a watch. Like, Ali's the dude. Cause I really enjoy the horology. But for cars, I go to this car show every like one Sunday every month. And that's where I kind of get my fix to be around cars. So those two things have some sort of like innate childhood memory that's attached to it. But I don't really spend money on other things. Like I don't see the enjoyment of just spending money for the sake of spending.
Me neither. The one thing that I do find that's important to me when it comes to money is I want to pull up to a house that I am proud of.
Yeah, for sure.
I get up at 4 a.m. I've been doing this for a very long time. I want to pull up to a home and I want to walk in and go, okay, this is the reason why I'm doing this right here. And that might be the only material thing. But outside of that, man, I mean, as far as you could have watches in front of me right now, I couldn't tell you the fake Rolex from the real Rolex, the expensive watch from the, the experience is for me.
Do you feel like you live within your means, beneath your means, or above your means?
I have business people that tell me to live within my means. And when I go over that, they say, you are not allowed to do that.
Okay.
The only monetary awareness that I really have is the number that I want to be at to retire. And I have a business manager that says, look, if you take another trip this year, you're going over that. You're going to have to work another 6 months.
What's that number?
I don't want to say.
Why?
I just don't.
Why? Can I guess?
You can, but I wouldn't say.
Why?
I don't know. I just don't like talking about those kind of things.
I love talking about money. I feel like it's important.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah.
It's $20 million. You look like a $20 million type of guy.
That's way more than what. Yeah, I'm playing.
Well, then you can get there very quickly if it's less than 20. But
you also got to remember I lost more than half of what I had in a divorce. So I started all over again 7 years ago. I had a nice little nest egg going. And
so you know you live within your means because you have like financial managers. So do you really feel like you're not like in tune with the business side of finances?
I do not.
Wow.
I absolutely do not.
I think most people I hang out with are the opposite.
Me too.
Yeah.
Really? Definitely the anomaly. I'm in a business group.
Yeah.
And I walk in there and those guys are talking terms that I have no idea about. I'm like,
and
hey,
do you
guys
even care? Like, because you have people around you that you trust, obviously.
Yeah.
So do you even really need to care?
It puts me in a pretty vulnerable state.
Yeah.
I do know this, that over the years, because I didn't take enough business classes or didn't pay attention in business classes, I've lost hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
And I only know that in looking back, because when I – let me take podcasting, for instance.
Yeah.
When the Burt Show started podcasting, I really had no idea what a CPM was. I had no idea how we were getting paid. And we were bringing in some really good numbers.
Yeah.
And I had a partner that gave me a 3 CPM at the time.
Yeah.
And what I didn't know
was how long ago was this?
It's about 7 years ago. All right.
So let's drop some marketing knowledge on the people that are listening here. So CPM is cost per milli, which is cost per 1,000 impressions. Mm-hmm. And in most marketing worlds, you're talking about $15 to $30 is sort of the CPM that people want to be around, depending on your industry. So you're getting offered $3 CPM.
And I have no idea about podcasting, no education, trusted way too much, and only found out years later when I dissolved the partnership because I started feeling a lot of shady things that he was taking 15.
Yeah.
And he was giving me 3.
Wow. Yeah. Isn't it funny that I guessed that number before you even said anything? I was like, 15 to 30 is the range.
You're
and
right,
7
man.
Years ago. Yeah, it's about right.
Yeah. So, I mean, hundreds of thousands of dollars lost there. And, you know, maybe one day I'll ask my maker, like, you know what? How much did I lose by not paying attention in those business meetings? Or maybe at that point I just won't care. But it certainly is.
Does it still sting you a little bit?
No.
Yeah.
In the past.
You feel like you've forgiven him?
Nah, but there were other things involved in that.
Yeah. So I was watching this. I don't know if it was a podcast or a show or something, but someone was saying forgiveness is not about the other person. It's about you.
Sure.
And
I agree with that.
I have this. So I think about money in so many different ways that I even break it down to how many hours a year do I work? And if I'm working, let's say 2,000 hours a year, that's an average of 40 hours a week with 2 weeks of vacation time. And let's say my income was $200,000 for the year. Mm-hmm. That means my time is worth $100 per hour. And so if I spend 10% of my time thinking about this person, it's almost like I'm giving them $20,000 right. worth of mental value.
That's a great way to look at it.
And I tried to explain this to my younger brother because, dude, the bigger your business gets, the more you're going to be sabotaged, the more people are going to take advantage of you.
Oh,
like,
boy, tell me, man.
My losses, the swings are insane. Like, you know, small villages, you know? And it's okay because I know that the speed of my growth outpaces the speed of my problems.
So the loss of money bothers me way less than the loss of trust.
Oh, 100%. Like, I agree with you. Yeah,
as you're
I agree
saying,
with
sabotage,
you.
Yeah. And, you know, I've done this for a long time and put my faith into a lot of people that I thought I was a good judge of character. I learned over the last year and a half, I will never say that about myself ever again. But the loss of that loyalty from other people or having that trust hurts way more than the money does.
That's why it's important to have those sorts of people that surround you. Like, you should never be the smartest person in your group.
I assure you I am not ever.
And I'll tell you this, I'm realizing there's value in also me not being the only decision maker.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's, when I look at the CEOs of companies that really feel like they are making all the decisions, they've got this great cabinet of people. Like, when I look at the Burt Show, you probably have this in your office also. When I look at the Burt Show, this is a cabinet of people that I hired and respect.
Yeah.
So why would I bring them in, listen to them, and then not take their advice? It's ridiculous.
Yeah, you don't hire smart people to tell them what to do. You hire smart people so they can tell you what to do.
Right.
Now, I think most bosses have a problem with empowering their leadership team to make those executive decisions. So I think in your world, because you know your lane and you'd like to stay in it and you want to be the creative mind and that's the direction that you take it, I'm sure in those meetings you're taking a lot of the leadership. But that's just one element of the business. Now, and I don't know if this is the same for other CEOs, but for me, I genuinely feel like I'm very, very good at a lot of things in my business. And I just sort of started hiring the things that were easiest to find the qualified candidates for.
Mm-hmm.
But there are certain parts of the business that I'm still very, very involved in. And it's hard to find someone to replace me because I'm just too good at it.
Sure. I mean, just having that working knowledge of yourself, so long as it's not ego-based. And I think when you're talking about a lot of CEOs, I think they are really me first, me first, me first. Whereas, are you familiar with that? Do you follow basketball at all?
A little bit.
All right. So Phil Jackson, Chicago Bulls, they used to run the triangle.
Right.
That's how I like to sort of live my life and live my business also, is that everybody gets the ball. I don't care who's shooting. I don't care who is assisting. So long as we are scoring the most points, I couldn't care less if I'm the one scoring or not. And I think it's the same thing with a boardroom and CEOs also. I think there are a lot of CEOs that just like to shoot and take credit and they don't give the proper credit to the ones that are really making them what they are. And that's just, that's not my thing, man. I like to assist as much as I like to score.
Do you think you've always been like that?
I have.
Yeah?
Yep.
So has your mindset about business changed at all over the past 20, 25 years that you've been doing the Burt Show?
Has my mindset on business changed?
Surely on people and the level of trust that you give to them, because I'm sure you've learned some difficult lessons.
Yeah, I have. Sometimes I feel like I'm repeating the same one over and over and over again. Like I don't follow my gut.
Well, you're that means you're very smart. Because you don't learn from one mistake. You do it multiple times to make sure you learn from it.
Oh yeah, that I have, right? So, you know, your gut doesn't lie to you.
Yeah.
Your mind can lie to you, but I don't feel like your gut does.
You don't listen to your gut is when you get messed up.
That's when you get really messed up. And my gut is really never wrong, but my head says, hang on, your gut's not right here. And every time I've said that, I've lost. I'm sure you've had the same experience.
Yeah, there are people that I've already fired in my head, in my organization, because of things that they've told me. And I know that they're not going to last because of the personality that they have.
So why not let them go now? What's the reluctance?
Redundancy and resiliency in your business.
Explain.
If you're going to terminate someone, you have to be prepared to have a backlash. Mm-hmm. You have to be prepared for them potentially taking people with them. Mm-hmm. You have to be prepared to have access to all the controls, the logins, everything else. The dumbest thing you can do is just cut someone out without being strategic.
You know what I love about this conversation here? And this is really, life is Game of Thrones. And I really feel like business is Game of Thrones. And I really feel like what you're talking about is everything that they show us on Game of Thrones. Is like, sometimes you got to eliminate people, you try to do the right thing, but you have to have a successor in place. Who do you trust? Being betrayed. Yeah. You know, it's the same type thing.
Business is a sport. I mean, if you want to be good at business, you have to be able to juggle so many different issues all at the same time. You have to have good people management skills. You have to have good leadership development skills. You have to have the right level of not just managing your people, but also delegating work, mm-hmm. not over-delegating and not under-delegating. Mm-hmm. So there's this sort of like fine line that you have to tiptoe on. You want people to grow. You want people to make a lot of money, but you also don't want them to be very money hungry. You want people that are motivated to be with you and the mission that you have, but not fangirling because they're like, oh, I've seen you on all this stuff on media, so I just want to be with you for a short period of time so I can get my fix and move on. Mm-hmm. So it really takes a specific type of personality, and that's why I think we've gone through thousands of employees to keep the 70 or so that we have right now. Maybe not thousands, definitely hundreds, but thousands of resumes. Because here's where I am in business right now. I know when someone needs to get terminated because of poor performance, because of work ethic, because of personality, but I don't make that decision because I want to empower my leader to make that decision on their own. And if it takes them 6 months to figure out that this person is the wrong fit, mm-hmm. they're going to struggle for 6 months, and I'm going to pay 6 months of payroll to a useless person because it's more important that my leader learns that lesson.
Yeah, I really respect the way that you do business. I really do. If I was watching this or I was listening to this and I was wondering, like, which team do I sign up for, I'd have more confidence in your way than mine. Mine's a little flighty.
You seem fun, though.
I'm fun.
I mean, I'm fun, but I think I give the personality, I think I give the vibe that, hey, business first,
yep.
play later.
And I have been burned many times with the emotion of it, putting that first and business second.
Do you feel like because you're overly, like, I feel like you're friends with a lot of your team members, yes. your employees.
I love them. Seriously, the best team I've ever had right now.
And so these are like not just like employer-employee relationships, but actual close friends. People that are at your house, you're hanging out with them. You probably go on vacations with them.
I don't go on vacations
with them. Okay, so you don't so there is a line that you draw.
Yeah, for
so
sure.
So yes, there's friendly, like it's different. It's cool to go out and have dinner and whatever, right, hang out.
Yep.
But there is a line that you draw between like, this is the extent of the friendship that we're going to have in this capacity? Or do you have some employees that are all in on the friendship?
So Kristen, who has been with me now for 12 years, I mean, she's more than somebody that I work with, right? Everybody in that studio and my support staff, if I have time, I would hang out with.
Yeah.
Right? I would go to a Braves game with. I would go out and I would have drinks with. Kristen's like sort of, she's like a confidant. She's like my work wife. But everybody there, I am friendly with.
Yeah.
Friend, yeah, I would consider them friends. It's not somebody I'm hanging out with all the time, though, because, you know, I think you probably go through this also, that you only have so much slice of a pie for everything going on in your life, you know, work, family. For me, social is way down on the list. So my friend group has become much smaller because I cherish those intimate times with them, and I just don't have enough time to spend with all the people that I really want. So I would say we're all friends and we're all friendly. But I mean, as far as time goes outside of the studio, there's not a whole bunch of that.
Do you feel like they'll still be your friends if it wasn't for the employer-employee relationship?
We would all be in contact with each other for sure. Yes. There is not anybody on that staff that I think if I left tomorrow wouldn't want to hang out or I wouldn't want to hang out with.
Well, if you left, it's different. The circumstances of the departure of the employer and the employee drastically changes the outcome of the friendship.
I think a lot of that also has to do with the way they leave. I mean, I guess there is this blurry line. You know, I've had people leave in a very respectful way.
Yeah.
I've had people leave in ways that don't really match my values.
Yeah.
I'm not in touch with those people anymore. And I'm lightly in touch with the ones that used to work for us, still connected, but I wouldn't say like friendly. I would say friendly. There's a fine line. Like, I was just on the phone yesterday with a former employee that's going through a breakup, and I was talking him through this breakup. So, yeah, I guess I would say it.
You know, I think if any employee wants to leave their employer, doing it in a respectful manner is always going to yield more fruit than cutting ties, burning bridges.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I just can't, you know, as far the ethics of it, I lose sleep if I do things that don't go along with my definition of my values and my ethics. Now, I have made those mistakes before, but I have such a guilty conscience when I do things the wrong way that I can't leave a job that way. I just can't. And it's very hard for me to understand when people do. It hurts.
I think
more.
It's a level of maturity. I think people, there's, you know what's right and wrong. I think innately, children, babies, they know what's right and wrong. After like age 4, they kind of have a sense of what you should do and what you shouldn't do. But some people use the lack of experience for a given situation as their crutch for why they acted out a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to, if they want to leave their job, they want to do it in the most horrific, like I'm taking this place down with me type of vibe. Whereas I've taken a different approach where I strategically talk to my team and say, hey, here's the direction that we're going. Here's our goals for this quarter, this year, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. Here's the vision. And there's enough room for everyone on this rocket ship to success. But if you don't feel like you want to put in the work, then I ask you, I implore you, I beseech you to send me your resignation. I will pay you to leave and I will write you a letter of recommendation to find a different employer. And one person has taken me up on that. Two people have taken me up on that. And so far, it doesn't seem like there's been any sort of negative backlash. We're still friends. We still kind of hang out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was the best thing because now I'll still go out of my way to make sure that they're happy and successful if there's anything that I can do to help them. But then there's people that are on the complete opposite end of the extreme and they want to take you down with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it comes from a position of jealousy. I guess that's kind of like my litmus test for why people mistreat someone in a successful position is because of jealousy. There's like a deep-rooted feeling that you don't deserve what you have, and I want to make sure that this exit of mine is going to be as painful as possible for you because I don't feel like you've deserved what you currently have. It's either that or racism for me.
So there's a psychology behind it, too, that I struggle with because on my team, I feel like I try to build up everybody on my show as much as I can and make them feel great about them and bring them into the process. there are some that I've had on the team that take that, that momentum and that feel good, and then I feel like misinterpret it like, well, you'd be nowhere without me.
Yeah.
So I'm going to take off, or look, I'm the reason why you're here and I can do it better somewhere else. So they take off in that way.
Yeah. It's funny. I don't think I ever feel what you just described. I have never ever felt, nor do I think I'll ever feel like, hey, I made you mm-hmm. into who you are, because I can give you the blueprint. I give so much free legal information, business information, marketing strategies. Dude, I give people my template for my law firm, mm-hmm. which took me years to build. I give it to people for free, but they still don't know how to execute. So execution is everything. So I never feel like I made someone into who they are, mm-hmm. but
I just want to make my point clear yeah. that I'm not saying I made them.
Yeah.
I'm saying I build them up. And they misinterpret it at the end of the day and say they are the ones that are responsible for my success.
Oh, yeah, okay.
That's a very different message.
No, I know you were saying it in the negative, like you don't feel that way. And I definitely don't. I was agreeing with you that I never feel that way, because I think, like, you know, you earned it. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, I gave you the opportunity, but you executed on it. But there's also people that you give them an opportunity, they take it and run with it, and then leave you hanging out to dry mm-hmm. at the end of it.
Yeah, I struggle with that. I really struggle with it. I want to get back to something you said before, because you asked me this question. I want to ask you the same one. How many of your employees or people that you work with equally are you friendly with outside of work?
Outside of work?
Mm-hmm. Would you consider them friends? Or do you guys have roles and they're part of your structure and your business, but you're not friendly with them?
Look, in the beginning, it's... So if you have 5, 10, 15 employees, you can have a good, strong relationship with every single person. Mm-hmm. And as we've grown, it's gotten harder. So people have to kind of be around for a year or two before we've had enough conversations where I kind of like get a vibe for, you know, where they are. But I would say there's at least 5 people that I would consider friendly, like at least. And that's just because they've been with me for, you know, over 2 years. The business is only like 6, 7 years old. So it's like, if you've been with me for 2 or 3 years, like we're friends at mm-hmm. this point, you know? And it's just harder for me to establish those types of close relationships with people in the first 3 to 6 months. But definitely outside of work, when that opportunity arises, it's like, yes, let's go and hang out.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
Got it.
And I really cherish those relationships, because I don't really have that many friends.
Mm-hmm.
I don't relate to a lot of the friends that I kind of grew up with. Everyone's gone in their own sorts of paths. And I, like, even tonight, I'm planning a dinner with some friends. So I put them all in a group chat, and it just felt like so weird. It's like, why am I doing this? Like, I want to try to be that extrovert, mm-hmm. but I'd much rather just be at home and like order a pizza and just chill with my wife and son. And it's weird.
So then why do you do it?
Okay. Why do I do it? Well, first, the main reason is because right now we're fasting. It's during Ramadan.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an obligation to check in with your Muslim brothers and sisters. And so we're going to have iftar. So I haven't eaten since like 3 a.m. today. And I've been fasting all day at 8 o'clock. We're going to do some Korean barbecue. And then afterwards, we're going to go to the mosque. And that's something that I feel like it's beneficial for Muslim brothers to kind of break bread together at least once during Ramadan, because we're at the end of the month. That's primarily the reason. Outside of that, this is going to sound super cocky, okay? Outside of that, I feel like most people that come into my life, I enrich them.
Mm-hmm.
I increase some sort of value in their life, and I leave them with something better than where they had before. And I'm not taking this from like a religious perspective or anything. I just genuinely feel like deep down in my heart, I'm a good, positive person. And I like when other people are successful.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy seeing people become successful around me. And when I have friends that I've known for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, I feel like maybe from a selfish perspective, I want to give them that time, and I feel like they're deserving of it, just because we've kind of gone through so many things together over the years. Even if we don't relate, we don't talk to each other as much, I feel like, even though I'm not doing it intentionally, I feel like having a dinner, having a talk, or just sitting down and brainstorming together – you're going to leave with something better than when we started the conversation.
So when you have a group of friends, this is really interesting to me, you're sort of subconsciously assigning a value to yourself and to them.
So you asked specifically for this group of people that I'm hanging out with. And because I kind of did the, like I initiated it, whether I'm paying for the meal or I'm giving them a good time or we're going somewhere fun, I do assign a value of my role is to make sure that everyone enjoys this experience. But when it's the other way around, when I'm going to meet, you know, with them and hanging out, I'm just a lazy bum sitting on the couch, like, cause I need to unwind. Like right. I still have those experiences, but I just know that being around other people, I know I'm going to add value to your life. And I know that sounds like super cocky, but I promise you there is something going on in your life that I've already experienced that I know how to give you an answer to. And if we talk about it for a few minutes, you're going to leave in a much more positive state. And I went through a period in my life where I stopped giving people advice because I realized I was giving advice without any sort of appreciation for it. And I don't like that happened. I feel like if I have something to give to the world or to my friends or anyone, I want to do it. And I don't want to be disincentivized to not do it. So, yeah, I do put a value on me. And I'm not looking to get any value from other people. I'm looking to give value for me.
There's a part of that, a huge part of that, that I'm struggling with right now. And as I'm listening to you, I wish that I had that. You said cocky, and I'm not saying this in a bad place, that ego, that id, because I feel like I do not value myself or put a value on what I offer people often enough.
You don't feel like you put a value on what you offer people?
Mm-hmm. I just don't see it that way. Yeah. So
no, so it has nothing to do with like fame or social media or anything else. I genuinely feel like I'm an intelligent, honest, good-hearted person. And I think those traits matter wherever you go.
For sure.
Yeah, and so I want to give you some of that. And I do have friends that I feel like are superior to me in knowledge or income or in their relationships or leading their children or their families, their religious lives. So I do have those sort of like mentor relationships, and I love those relationships, but they also understand what I'm bringing to the table. But for a lot of my friends that I grew up with, they don't really have much to offer outside of let's have a good time. And so I feel like it's kind of my obligation, maybe because I'm a little bit older than them. So that's why I relate more to older people. Yep. But the friends that I grew up with, it's like, I'm going to make sure we have a good time and you're going to get some value out of this.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's, it might sound cocky. I'm just trying to express it.
Yeah. I don't know that it's cocky. It's real. For me, again, it's just trying to figure out who to hang out with. And I guess it's a value-added thing also. It's just that I just don't have a lot of time anymore. So the people that I hang out with, I just really want to make sure that they are
worth your time.
That I can have quality time with. Not worth my time, just quality time. I guess maybe we're saying the same thing, just different terms.
So look, I'm selfish in the way that I have to get some sort of value out of any relationship. And sometimes the value is enough for me to enjoy your presence. That's enough value for me because I'm happy being with you. I enjoy our conversation. That's plenty of value. And sometimes the value is in that you actually listen to the advice that I'm going to give you. And especially times 10, times 100, if you execute on it. Because now it's sort of this selflessness, selfishness that I feel good that I gave you something that you took advantage of. And I feel good that I gave it to you and I want to keep giving it to you more.
Yeah. That's a really great way to do business also. I was giving somebody on my show this advice a couple of weeks ago. He started a Twitch channel and he doesn't really know what he's doing.
Yeah.
And he's trying to fake it. And I said, that's the worst thing you can do. Let your audience, which at this point is like 5 people, guide you, tell them that you are clueless.
Yeah.
And when you do that and they invest in your Twitch channel and you take their advice, they will be invested for life.
100%. Mm-hmm. This, I literally did a webinar last week to teach lawyers how to market and how to bring in cases with $0 in ad spend. So most people look at my social media presence, they look at all the videos and the media team and all this stuff and think, man, I can't compete with that. And right, because you shouldn't compete with my game. You mm-hmm. should compete in your game.
Right.
And your game is the 500 to 1,000 friends that you have on Facebook. Every single one of those should know what you do, what services you provide, and how to hire you if they need that service. Mm-hmm. And if you are not strategically or even subliminally marketing to them by sharing stories of your success and of your business and the things that you do, not advertising, but just sharing the stories, you are failing at marketing. So don't try to go after all these other people. Go after the people that are right in front of you.
Yeah, and I think people get it a little bit twisted when it comes to success also. They look at numbers. You've got mad numbers on Instagram, right? For me, I tell my podcasters that
the but rich, you've got mad numbers on podcasts. Like your numbers are nuts.
It's a little nutty, right? Yeah. I tell my podcasters that are starting out, though, like, don't look at my numbers. Yeah. Forget it, right? I've got a national radio show.
Yeah.
You're not going to be able to get over 200,000 downloads a day,
yeah,
at least in your first week.
Yeah, and you've been at that's it for 20, 30
yeah,
years.
Right. You know, like, for me, the riches are in the niches. You've heard that cliche, 100%. I'm sure. And that's what you're talking about here also. You can't be CEO lawyer, but find your niche and be the best at that niche, and your audience, your clients, what your business will grow from there.
So it's a really good point that you just made, because people think you have to appeal to the masses in order to become like famous or successful or whatever. When the truth is, you focus on one specific niche, and let's say it's plumbers and HVAC contractors throughout America, and you just create content specifically for those people, for contractors and subcontractors, DIY, like you're good at plumbing and HVAC and that's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And there might be a couple hundred thousand people in America that are like so in tune with exactly the type of content that you're providing. And if you own that space, you can always evolve and add more skills to your repertoire.
Absolutely.
But everyone will eventually know that you're famous. They just don't know how you got famous.
I don't even know why anybody would want to be famous.
Yeah, it kind of sucks, actually.
Yeah.
Like, people, like, following you around and taking pictures and, like, yeah, it's not as enjoyable.
I wouldn't think...
I wish I could figure out how to make a lot of money without having to do the other stuff.
I don't know why anybody would want to, like, have people follow them around or have that kind of pressure, and everything you're saying is being...
Criticized
and dissected. I wanted to get back to that the niches are... or the riches are in the niches, yeah, type thing, and I'm going to use... the podcast format as an example. So I just wrote this book called Listenable.
Yes. Excellent book. Everyone go out and get it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. If you're starting a new podcast, I really think it's mandatory. And I'll tell you why. I am not a podcasting expert. That is not my niche.
Yeah.
If you ask me right now, what is the best mic to use when it comes to podcasting, I would call my marketing person and say, hey, Cassie, like, what's the best mic to use? If you ask me about marketing, I wouldn't know. My niche, and there is nobody that does it better, is content and delivery, which is what Listenable, that book, is all about. That is my niche. Nobody does it better than I do. Nobody knows how to tell a story. Nobody knows how to direct content the way I do. And most podcasts are failing right now because they are skipping that step. And it's the most important step in podcasting. So using myself as the example here, my niche is content and delivery. People are going to think I'm a podcasting expert. Yeah. I am not. That book will sell when people read it and they realize, oh my God, this is so important. And I have a team of experts that can answer the other questions, but my niche, and that's the only thing I'm focused on, and I don't even have the desire to learn everything about podcasting, but I know that I'm really great at content and delivery, and that's what I do.
When you say that the storytelling aspect is what's missing, do you feel like people are just putting out content because they think that's what they should be doing versus telling a story? Explain what you mean by that.
Podcasting is silly this way. You know, I've said this since the very beginning of listening to podcasts. The greatest thing about podcasting is that anybody can do it.
Yeah.
And what's the worst thing about podcasting?
That anyone can do
it. Anybody can do it, right? And if you apply entertainment in any other medium, it sounds silly. If you walked onto a movie set never taking a class on film or acting and said, hey, everybody back off, right? Give me the mic. And then you started acting, you would suck and people would laugh you right off the set.
Yeah.
That's what's happening with podcasting, is that anybody can get a mic.
Yeah.
Anybody can learn within 15 minutes what computer you need and how to edit, but they have absolutely no idea how to build a story. They have no mission statement. And everybody thinks that their life is super entertaining, and it's not. So all these amateur podcasters are starting talking about their lives. Nobody knows who they are. They have no lane to go to, and they don't know how to weave through a story the way you either naturally do or somebody has taught you to do it. They just don't have that skill, and that's why 75% of podcasts are failing in the first year.
I mean, I think I sort of built a brand on other platforms and then came to podcasting afterwards. So I do feel like my stories are interesting.
And I'm sure, and I, you're a very good storyteller.
Yeah. No, and, but I mean, like, I think people actually want to know, like, my stories growing up. But I agree with you that for the most part, when you're starting out and you don't have a brand or you have, look, I already invested 5-6 years of crazy content production on social media before I started the podcast. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I get to talk about myself and people want to listen to it because I kind of built that foundation.
You can have an amazing story, but if you don't know how to tell it, then people aren't going to be interested. Yes, you have a great story, but you also have a great gift on relaying that story. If there was somebody just like you right there and they tried to deliver their life and they didn't have the same communication skills you had, they're going to fail. You're going to do well. You're gifted.
Do you feel like communication is something that could be learned, or does it have to be innate, like powerful communication and storytelling?
I think there's got to be a seed of talent there.
Right?
Yeah.
I think you can like read all about it and study and try things, but I think it boils down to, does it feel natural? It's almost like a great singer. Like you can tell when someone is singing effortlessly and doing a great job versus the people that are really, really trying and honing in, because it's like polishing a turd versus like, it's gold, dude. Right. It's already gold. Doesn't matter if it's beat up, if it's just woke up, if it's like in the dirt, it's gold.
Yeah. I think that there are some people that can be trained to be, how do I say this? An actor acting as somebody that is engaging and knows how to tell a story. I think you can be trained in that way.
You want to know what's my most pressing issue right now in content creation?
What?
It's I'm trying to get deep into a conversation without considering the sound bites that are on camera that are inevitably going to be on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok after this show.
So as we've been talking, have you been thinking about sound bites as they're coming out of your mouth?
Just then I was thinking about a sound bite, but as we were getting deeper into the conversation, you can typically tell, and all my media team knows, when my inflection, my voice rises and my eyebrows go up, you know I'm about to tell an awesome story. And it's like, you better get this on camera. And it's unprepared and unscripted. So that's one of the difficult things for me, because I'm so in tune with what I want the audience to experience that I speak in sound bites. Mm-hmm. I almost speak in cliffhangers too. Mm-hmm. It's like the most important thing that you can do in podcasting is, because I know this is going to be a 10-second clip that's going to be on Instagram. Right. You got to swipe up and go to my YouTube channel. So I'm trying to get out of that, because I feel like when I break down those walls, the true raw me is what people want to see.
Absolutely.
What about you? Do you feel like you're on the radio all the time? You have cameras on you all the time.
Yep.
Do you feel like you can just shut it off, avoid the cameras, and say whatever happens is going to be good? Or do you also keep in mind the consumer experience?
Well, again, I think you have to know who your audience is and be hyper focused on what your content is. So in that way, yes. But while we're on the air, while you and I are talking, I think one of the reasons why I enjoy talking to you so much, I love this kind of relationship. You and I are very different people, business-wise, religious-wise, lifestyle-wise, so different, but respect each other so much.
Absolutely.
Yet also can hear each other and express differences and learn from each other each and every time we're with each other. And I think that's what you and I do. The way Your mind fascinates me because it's moving all the time. It's a, it feels like it's a constant calculation. If we're not talking about finances, if we're not talking about how many hours you're putting in on your mind, it's like a watch, right? And the face of the watch is really basic, but when you take that thing off, it's just a whole bunch of moving parts.
I appreciate you telling me I have a basic face.
I'm not saying that.
No, but even right now, as we're talking about this right now, it's almost like I have timestamps of our entire conversation. And in storytelling, I think it's really important to tie it back into the main question, the main idea from the very beginning. I think it's part of comic genius. The best comedians are the ones that can tell a story throughout their entire skit. They start with some sort of theme, and then they have all these little sort of mini stories along the way. Mm-hmm. And the very last punchline is something related to some of the first words that they talked about.
It's the old callback, man.
So I have all these timestamps just from our conversation. and I think one of the things I'm actually really good at is tying it all in.
Yeah.
And so I ask you this. We started the conversation with, do you feel like your mind has sort of changed in terms of your business acumen over the years? And now the conversation sort of shifted into like podcasting, content, and delivery, and that's kind of your strong suit. Do you feel like your mindset on content and delivery has changed over the years?
No. Always been the same. I mean, people's listening habits have changed over the years. The content has had to change because we have to be way more PC now than we used to.
Yeah.
But the audience is the audience, right? And I have to look at trends in listening. And this is the beauty about podcasting also is I can do it in snackable bites also, like 5 minutes, 6 minute bites rather than an entire hour, which is another problem I think with podcasting, but that's a convo for another time. So look, content and delivery is at, and connection is at the is at the meat of everything we do, be it video, be it radio, be it podcasting, be it a lawyer. You have to connect. You have to know how to tell a story. You have to know how to deliver that story quickly, and you have to connect with your clients in a very fast way. We're in the same business. We're all in the connection business. We're all in the communication business. And the ones that can do it well, succeed.
So you said that you're the absolute best at content and delivery.
I'm one of the best, yep.
So are there any other people that you aspire to be like, or anyone that you're like, hey, this person kind of motivated me along my journey, or this like, hey, this guy is really, really good at what they do?
Sure. I grew up in San Diego, and there was a radio show out there called Jeff and Jer, and I grew up every single morning listening to these guys. And they just had so much fun and enthusiasm with everything they did. And even now when I go back and I listen to old shows of theirs, I want to bring that to our show every single day, that fun and that excitement. I worked with my mentor, and he ended up being a brother to me. Kid Craddock was the most talented guy I have ever worked with in my life. I don't have his talent, but I learned so much from him over the years that I was really lucky to have him in my life for as long as I had. But I also have a tendency to listen to podcasters and listen to talent as a listener of the audience that they are trying to attract. For instance, Call Me Daddy. Mm. That podcast is not for me. That is for 22-year-old girls, right? But it is a brilliant podcast for who it is trying to communicate with. And I think there's real beauty in saying, hey, this is not for me, but I understand why it is for you.
You got me thinking now that, like, I'm just recording content just because I like talking to people and I like having conversations. But I don't think I'm intentional about the specific audience I'm shooting after on podcasting or YouTube or anything like that. I have my business content where it's like, hey, I need clients to hire me when they're in an accident. Mm-hmm. And I have all this marketing and advertising budget. But I treat podcasting and YouTube kind of just like an outlet for creativity. And I really don't care what direction it goes. And I don't even care if you don't listen. You know, I just want to talk. But are you saying that I should be a little bit more intentional with the audience I'm trying to attract and who I'm speaking to?
Only you know that, who your audience is. I do know this, that I came in and I was handed a list of questions that you and I were supposed to go over with CEO lawyer, right?
Yeah.
And we haven't touched on one of them. And for me, this is a very intriguing, connective conversation. So I'm not sure who your audience is. I know I'm having a blast.
You know, I think there is a population of young Muslim and immigrant kids that watch my content and get inspired.
That's beautiful.
And maybe those are the ones that I'm talking to. And so I feel like I try to keep it PG sometimes, but there is a side of me that's a little bit more, you know, rated R. And I want to make sure that I'm giving people like quality information that they could potentially, you know, get value from. But there's also tons of lawyers now, like by probably like 50,000 lawyers that follow me.
So I feel like, and I don't know all of your formats. So what we're doing right now, does that go into your funnel as the attorney, or is that the funnel building clients? Are you talking to lawyers right now? Or are you talking to potential clients?
That's the thing. I'm not talking to anyone else but you. Here's the thing. I think I know enough brilliant people, exciting people, successful people, that a conversation into the mind of the successful person is going to bring value to someone.
For sure.
And I know that with every moral fiber of my being. So I don't need to talk to a specific audience. I just want to talk to you. And wherever the conversation goes, someone is going to benefit from it. Mm-hmm. And I don't really pay attention to like the metrics on YouTube and podcast. Whether it's 4 people or 400 people that listen, I really don't care.
I find that hard to believe. You're so calculated.
No.
With everything else. That you don't check the numbers at all?
Those numbers I don't care about.
Huh.
Yeah. The numbers on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, 100% care about, because I have a 6-figure marketing budget every month. So obviously I need to know where my money's going. On this stuff, it's just for fun. Mm-hmm. And it kind of like opens up this creative, like I had a conversation the other day with the spiritual leader at my mosque, and the conversation went into why interest is forbidden in our religion, why charging interest and paying interest is forbidden. Huh. And we went into, and I 100% believe it because I'm Muslim, and that's a very common knowledge, but a lot of people will just kind of Americanize it and say, hey, it's okay, you can do it. So credit cards, obviously not allowed. If you can pay it within 30 days and not get hit with interest. The only exception is a loan on your home to get a mortgage.
Is there a short, snackable way to tell me why?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Actually,
very interesting.
Yeah, it just got posted today. Actually, the short, snackable way is basically this. In Islam, loans are traditionally a form of charity. When someone needs a loan, it's typically because they have a need in their life and they don't have the financial resources to do it. And we believe that the best types of loans are ones where you ask for nothing in return. Mm-hmm. But if you are going to loan someone, then the bare minimum type of charity is to get exactly what you got back. So in our religious scriptures, the examples that are given are, if I give you a couple of dates to consume, and like those are the dates that you needed for yourself or for your family, and you have to pay me back the same amount of dates. Mm-hmm. If it's a different type of date, then it has to be of equal value, equal or lesser value. But if I give you 5 dates and I say, well, you need to give me 6, right? I give you $5, you need to give me 6 back. That's interest. And it's the spirit of our religion of being able to help people in need that contradicts our purpose of being and helping others, which is why interest is, and usury specifically, excessive interest is forbidden in Islam.
So what I know about Islam is it is such a beautiful and peaceful religion, right? I think the branding of the religion because of extremists has really got people twisted about it. If anybody just spends 15 minutes understanding about Islam, it is an absolutely beautiful, kind religion. You can't tell Americans that.
Right? Well, I appreciate you saying
that. It's the truth. I'm not catering, man.
But let me ask you this. Do you know what's going on in France right now?
I don't.
Okay. Massive protests, like hundreds of thousands of people. Very, very serious. They're protesting the retirement age being pushed up.
I did know that, yes.
Do you know what's happening in China with the Uyghur Muslims?
I don't.
Concentration camps.
I didn't know that.
Right.
Nope.
There are obviously these world disasters that are happening everywhere in the world, but our media is so censored that you're not going to see all that information. Mm-hmm. So what you do see is exactly the type of information that's going to create divisiveness in our communities and in our society. So you have to have a boogeyman. September 11th, we found the boogeyman. Mm-hmm. Some random guy, somehow, in a cave in Afghanistan, committed the biggest terrorist attack on the country. And let's just not get into how two towers perfectly fell down in a controlled demolition where jet fuel burns at 2,000 degrees Celsius and the steel beams needed to burn at 4,000 degrees Celsius. Let's not get into all of that. Let's not get into why a seventh building in the Pentagon just collapsed on its own and nothing hit it. Let's just focus on how the Muslims are the boogeyman. Well, in order to go down that rabbit hole, you have to think about who controls the media, the perception that we have right now.
Oh, it's the government.
Well, the government controls some of it, but there are groups of elitists that control everything that you see and that you consume. And I'm sure you've heard of the TikTok ban.
Of course.
Why do you think TikTok, why do you think there's such a strong push for TikTok to get banned?
From an American standpoint?
From your personal standpoint.
Well, from my personal standpoint, I don't really buy into what the government is telling us about TikTok. I mean, I watched those hearings, and I thought it was absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
The evidence that they presented, I thought, was really fear-mongering more than anything else and playing to the lowest hanging fruit. And go on with your
it's because the boogeyman. So you're using the media to establish a boogeyman. They're trying to say China is the boogeyman, you know, every generation has their sort of boogeyman, right? So right now it's the Chinese and we don't want them to have access to all of our data, when in reality it's because TikTok is the only platform that has very little censorship in what's happening in other places in the world. The things that you see in France and China and everywhere else is not going to be visible on any other platform. And because Meta, Facebook, has such a strong hold on United States social media that they don't want any other competitors. In fact, the moment that the TikTok hearing started, Facebook canceled all monetization of their videos. They were basically like, well, we got this in the bag. We don't even need to pay you to be on our platforms anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I guess the point is this. The branding of Muslims has everything to do with the people that control the media. And if I really wanted to break this down into my first instinct was I need to make a lot of money for myself. When I started my business, that's what I cared about. I just need to make a lot of money for myself. I'm tired of being broke my whole life. I want to have a home. I want to have cars. I want to live a comfortable life. But then it sort of evolved into I want to give that type of lifestyle to other people. And I really feel like I pay my team well. I take care of them. I enjoy spending time with them. And the ultimate goal for me is to actually change the branding of Muslims. Mm-hmm. And the way I'm going to do that is by, number one, becoming very, very wealthy. And number two, by building the first Muslim hospital in America.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
And that's my BHAG, my big, hairy, audacious goal. And my hope is that this is going to be a 20, 30-year journey. My hope is that some people along the way, from different religious faiths, from, you know, whether they're agnostic or wherever they come from, they see that there is this Muslim person that's actually trying to do something good for society in America. And hey, maybe he's not trying to kill us all.
So here is my fear with the way that will be digested in the United States. And people need to know this, that when you're on Meta and you're on any social media platform, the algorithm is so sophisticated that it is giving you a very narrow view of what life is. Their only goal is to keep you on their platform. So when you click on some anti-Muslim literature propaganda, now the algorithm knows that, hey, they are really interested in anti-Islam, anti-Muslim literature. And they keep feeding it to you and keep feeding it to you. And it makes your view of the world very one-dimensional.
100%.
And my fear with the way that we're digesting any kind of news now is that depending on where you're getting it, everybody is getting manipulated. If you're watching CNN, they are feeding you a very specific type of information. They know who you are, and they want to keep you on that channel. It is the same for Fox. Is Fox ever going to cover your hospital? Never. Never, never, never.
Well, that's why we're building a brand. That's why I'm building a brand that I have control over the perception that other people have about me and hopefully about Muslims. And so I don't shove it down people's throats. Like, I'm not like, oh, Muslim in your face. Like, here's the Quran, read it, you know? Mm-hmm. But I'll have little bits and pieces here and there just to kind of remind people. And I see the most support from the people that are following my channels when I post that kind of content, because they're like, wow, this is an inspiration, because like, I'm this young Muslim kid and I grew up in this town and like, people hated me because of who I was. And that's why I feel like it's important to share my story. And look, whether I hit this goal or not, I know that the journey that I'm on is something that I enjoy. Mm-hmm. And if it takes me to a place that is successful in that aspect of building the first Muslim hospital, if it happens sooner, I'm going to build a lot more, mm-hmm. you know, but I'm enjoying the process now. And that's kind of the conversation that I wanted to like open up, was like, over the years, my mindset has evolved to being like super focused on, let me just make a lot of money, to, well, I have everything that I need. Like after the house and car, like you don't really need much mm-hmm. more, you know, being able to travel from time to time. It's just bigger, nicer things. That's all that changes, right? Once your needs are met, food is met, you have all your basic needs. At that point, I want to make sure that everyone around me has that same level of comfort. And once you've established that, now it's time to optimize the team. Everyone, we're all growing, we're all learning, we're all getting better. And I want to start really getting into, what's your true purpose? Like, why are you put on this earth?
That's exactly where I was going to lead this. This is really what the center of our conversation right now is, purpose. I mean,
yeah.
Spending money is nice, right? Giving it feels way better, right? It really, really does. But I feel like when I started my career, and I think you're probably going to share this also, is that it was about making as much as I could, as quickly as I could, and there were very few people around me that were really benefiting from that. It was empty. It's empty.
But you have to go on that journey. Like, I think it's okay. It's okay for you to spend a couple of years of your life to be like, look, I don't have time for hanging out with people. I'm not trying to establish a relationship. I don't want to get married or get in a in a super serious relationship with any other person. I just want to focus on me. I want to focus on my education, my income, my skill set, because it's going to attract the right person into your life if that's what you're looking for. So I think you are 100% allowed to have selfishness in your life. Mm-hmm. To focus on yourself to get what you want, because you can't pour from an empty cup. And I see all these people that are like, oh, I've poured so much into this person, or I spent all my time around other people. It's like, what if you took a couple of years to just focus on yourself? Mm-hmm. Imagine the amplification of greatness that you could have if you started with a bigger base. And that's why I think it's totally okay to be selfish for a couple of years, build yourself up, do your thing. But some people get sucked into it, and that becomes their personality for the rest of their lives.
Sure. The Burt Show was very satisfying to me when we were becoming successful. It became exponentially more exciting for me when we started Burt's Big Adventure. And this is the trip that we take down to Disney World with kids that have chronic and terminal illnesses.
And I absolutely love that. Like, I keep up with that content all the time. God, I love it. Yeah, I mean, what you're doing is incredible.
It's purpose. That's purpose that we're talking about.
How did you decide on taking kids with disabilities to Disney World?
Yeah, so years ago when I mentioned Kid Craddock to you, he had a very similar trip, and I was on his show for 2 years. So he took some kids down to Disney World also that have chronic and terminal illnesses. And when I was part of his staff, I thought, look, whenever I start my own show, I want to bring that to my city. And I only realized years later why that specific trip connected with me so much. And it's because my parents never took me on vacation. We never had that time together whatsoever. So as I got older, I realized that the time that these families have together is limited, like anybody's, but some of these kids we're talking about aren't going to be here in a couple of years.
It's really limited.
They're fighting a fight they can't win. So it became, I started to understand why that trip was so important to me. I wanted to provide for families that experience that I never had in such a unique way, which is Disney World. And one of the qualifications for our kids that this has to be your very first trip to Disney World with your family. So that's the purpose in the Burt Show and Burt's Big Adventure.
It's powerful, man. Like, when I went to that event, I was like, first, I was very impressed by just how beautifully everything went and seamless it was, how involved all the actors and actresses and parents were, how all the, you know, the Burt Show team, everyone was just like all in and excited. The energy was high. The vibes were great. And I felt very proud to be a part of it.
Thank you.
100%.
You've been a huge part, and I loved putting you on, and I love that you were so reluctant to come on. Because you really don't talk. I mean, you gave us a huge donation to one family, a huge, I think it was ended up being over $10,000, didn't it, just that day? Or was it more than that?
I don't share my donations publicly.
Oh, yeah, but you're going to ask me what my retirement number is.
I'll tell you mine. That's different.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't even want to know.
Yeah.
But you were so reluctant to come on, which really made me want to have you on.
Yeah.
Because it really showed where your heart was.
Well, I really don't like to share my donations. Like, the only people that know, my wife doesn't even know how much I donate. Hmm. Yeah. I think that's something between you and your creator.
Agreed.
And I also believe that if you can't donate when you're broke, you will not donate when you're rich.
There's also other ways to donate. When you're broke, your time. You can donate your time.
Oh, 100%. Uh-huh. And so I have this sort of nonprofit organization. It's not really a nonprofit. I just do work for nonprofits to help them get donations online.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we do it is I realized I'm good at social media. I'm good at the content creation. I'm good at the sort of web development, creating the funnels, getting people to elicit some sort of transaction from them. And because I have, you know, a decent knowledge of Islam, I know how to establish the right type of content to get people to click on a link, to go to a website, to make a donation, to become monthly donors. And I get more satisfaction out of that than anything else that I do. And
why?
So,
why?
Well, first, because I know how badly nonprofit organizations need it, because they mostly suck at marketing. Right? The Goodwills of the world don't need your money. Mm-hmm. They're not nonprofits. You know, because they're not. Mm-hmm. They don't need your money. It's the organizations that are really trying to do some good for the community that you don't hear about. Like, they supported this refugee family and, you know, were able to give them shelter for a couple of months and meals. This is not something that you're going to hear about. You go to Clarkston, it's the biggest concentration of refugees in Georgia.
That right?
Yeah. Hmm. And so, you know, if you ever want to do something good, go out to Clarkston and just meet with some of these families and give them whatever it is, whether it's food or clothes or money or whatever you have. And the reason this nonprofit digital donation business that I have feels good to me is because I'm actually utilizing my skills for a win-win situation. And so I'm exposing them to a way to collect donations, because most organizations don't really have a plan. They just ask and then hope that it ends up working out.
Mm-hmm.
So we create a plan that gives them consistent residual income from donors through digital platforms, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube. And we create the videos, we create the website, and give them something that works. And I think that's something that I can impact not just local communities, but nationally and internationally. It's a really, really big idea that feels really good doing it. And I just want to keep doing a little bit each year, mm-hmm. keep getting better at it each year. But kind of taking it back to the donations, I like to donate even when I am unable to, because it has to hurt a little bit. Because if you're not giving up something at least significant, or that you can't feel it, you're not really giving.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my perspective on donations. And we also believe, as Muslims, you can never go broke from donating.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go broke from giving something that you already have, right? Mm-hmm. You're not going to go into debt.
Right.
It's against our religion to go into debt or even donate mm-hmm. while you're in debt, because you obviously have other obligations to other people.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense. But just get in the habit of donating, mm-hmm. even if it's $5, $10, whatever you can. Round it up for the Christian's hospital at, you know, the checkout counter at Publix. You know, whatever small little thing, I think getting in the habit of these donations unlocks a piece of your heart that you're never going to get just from the financial aspect of your mind.
Couldn't agree with you more. I also look at them as donations of gratitude.
Yeah.
I really kind of feel like I've been very blessed in my life. I mean, I've created a lot of things that have opened doors for me, but in the overall scheme of things, I've been super lucky, and I have... Any donation for me is just like me telling my God, like, hey, thank you so much.
100%.
Uh-huh.
100%. Dude, this was a fun conversation.
We haven't talked about any of these.
Well, we're gonna do a separate... Okay. I wanted to have a conversation, get into your mind a little bit. I really enjoyed it because I got to see what a creative thinks like, or how a creative thinks you built a very successful enterprise, and
it was an accident. As I'm listening to you, it really was an accident. That's why I love being around businessmen like you, because I just don't think that way. Mine was an accident with guidance from others, but it was an accident.
If you're going to say that it's an accident, and I don't think it was, I would say that your sheer talent and your consistency, your relentless commitment is what made you successful. Because you had so much talent coupled with hard work, you were bound to be successful despite any sort of lack of business acumen. There's a lot of successful business people that don't have the creativity, don't have the personality. They're not going to be able to lead people because they can't create a vision, can't create a culture because they're so selfish. Even though they're really, really good at business, they don't have that element of their personality. And I think if you're really, really good at business and you can afford to pay people a lot of money, that's enough to build a successful company, right?
Right.
But you have your talents and your skill and your commitment and your consistency to the craft that attracted the right people and attracted a bigger audience. And because you got really, really good at it, you don't really have to focus on the money because it kind of worked itself out. Mm-hmm. And that's admirable. Well, I don't have that.
I appreciate that. I'm receiving that, as my fiance would say. I am receiving that. I appreciate it. Okay. I love our talks, man. I love hanging out with you and your wife at dinner.
Yeah, man.
I just really, really enjoy your essence. And she's awesome.
I appreciate that. Really, yeah, best awesome. Decision I ever made.
Man. No doubt.
I think the content we got to is like 1,000 times better than what I wrote out.
I mean, I agree. So for me, like when I'm pitching clients or you guys are pitching clients, this kind of conversation to me is what connects with a client. Not, you know, anybody can do this. There are so few dudes that can sit here and do what he just did.
Well, look. I mean, you make it very easy. Like, I've done tons of interviews, tons of podcasts. We did one in San Diego, not just like a month or so ago. And this guy had like, okay, I don't want to give you any details, but it was a horrible experience. Like, I don't even want to put it out publicly. And this dude is famous, but like having a normal conversation and just talking was not something that he could do. And I tried so hard to just like, have you ever had that? You ever had someone, guest on your show where you're going over and above just to be able to carry on a conversation?
Oh, yeah.
It's like, dude, come on, give me something.
You're only as good as your guests.
Yeah.
I mean, as an interviewer, I think that this is easy for you and I because I think we have a genuine interest in each other and our
100%.
Lives.
100%.
And we're curious people.
Yeah, no, I want to know more about, like, your mind and how you – I guess the business doesn't really – like, I love talking about business, don't get me wrong, but I'm more interested in the mindset. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and I bet we could talk for hours just about, like
– I think we just did.
Why do you keep going? Like, how do you keep going? What gets you committed? And, like, for me, it used to be money, and then it kind of evolved into, like, well, I like to be able to help out my people, and now it's like – I'm actually just really good at what I do, and I actually enjoy my work, so I don't have to have a reason. I'm just good at it, and I enjoy it.
You can tell.
Yeah.
You can tell. Like, the most boring part of business to me is talking about business. I hate talking about business. I hate talking about
numbers. I love talking about business.
I know you do.
But it's only because I know that after the conversation, either I'm going to benefit or you're going to benefit. So I've had, like, I've paid $100,000 to get a mentor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we'll do it over and over and over again because – if I get to spend a day with a billionaire just to see what their mindset is like, I'm going to learn so many different things and I won't apply them right away. It takes years to apply, but you start sort of planting these seeds. And the way I see entrepreneurship is if you plant a seed today and you go back to that seed the next day and you try to eat from it, all you're going to eat is dirt because it hasn't had time to sprout. You haven't given the sunlight, the water, and everything else. But if you wait a year, maybe it'll start yielding a little bit of fruit. Mm-hmm. And you can take a little bit of that fruit, eat it, and take some of the seeds and, you know, plant it again. Or you can let that plant get bigger and bigger and bigger. So the successful business people are the ones that, one, don't eat all the fruit that they produce in any given year. And two, continuously reinvest and plant more seeds every single year. So now it's like an orchard, man. When I look back, it's like, there are so many seeds that are being planted. I'm planting seeds still to this day. I don't expect that I'm going to eat from these seeds or these plants. I think my children, great-grandchildren might eat from them. But what you're seeing is the benefits of years and years of hard work.
People don't understand that.
They don't understand that, man.
That is really, that ideology is so super lost in every business, I feel like. It's like bottom line and get there quickly. That is no way to build an audience in any business. It's got to be a slow, connective grind. And it's something, you call it an orchard. That's exactly what it is. But it starts with one, and especially big businesses now want to see that success so quickly. And you can get success fast, but it doesn't stick. It doesn't connect.
Yeah, you got to go deep first before you go wide. So we are going to have a separate conversation about all the questions that you have written for me, but I just want to take a moment and say, hey, man, I really appreciate you just spending some time with me. I love our conversations. I feel like we could do this just for fun.
Yeah.
And yeah, man, I heard something, I think it was earlier today, that says, like, when you compliment someone that's at a higher status, that compliment doesn't really give, it doesn't really provide the same sort of value and flavor, because it's like, your opinion doesn't necessarily matter as much. But and I'm saying this with respect to me being the one that's at a lower status in terms of the business and the brand and things that you've built, because I really admire and respect what you've built, but I most admire and respect Bert's Big Adventure, and I know I want to be a part of it for as long as you'll have me, because there was like that sense of fulfillment was so good.
Yeah.
And I just want to keep doing more and more.
You are always welcome, man.
Yeah, man.
I love these
combos. So I appreciate it. Yeah. I appreciate you giving me that opportunity.
Thank you, man.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Appreciate you.
Bert Weiss with The Bert Show on the CEO Lawyer Podcast. Signing off.